Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here for episode 233 and part one of my conversation with longtime University of Texas at Austin percussion professor Tom Burritt. We'll get to him shortly. First up, random podcast I appear in. A favorite weekly sports podcast that I listen to is Hang Up and Listen, through the website slate.com. Recently, the hosts, Stefan Fatsis, Josh Levine, and Joel Anderson, had this running segment about a particular old school term that refers to blocking a shot in basketball called the pack, like packing a lunch, that co-host Joel brought up to Stefan and Josh, and the two of them had never heard of what Joel was talking about. They checked in with their extensive audience and heard from lots of folks all across the country, but none that had heard of the term in the Northeast where I grew up, which meant it was time for me to write into them about it. I did. I had some wonderful email exchanges with them and just assumed that would be it. Then, this past Monday, this topic about the pack gets brought up on the show for the last time. And all of a sudden, my name, job, and hometown, Locust Valley, New York, all get shout-outs. It was pretty cool. Anyway, I definitely recommend the show as a weekly listen if you are a sports fan. And if you want to hear them talk about it, it is the March 15th episode with the title, The Marvelousness of Marvelous Marvin Hagler. And my spot happens around the 1 hour and 4 minute mark. Check it out. I will have a link to the show in the notes. All right, this above sports connection is a useful transition to get to today's guest, Tom Burritt. I'd known of Tom for quite a while, even though I'd only recently met him before our interview. I'd seen him perform many times over the years at PASIC, which was always a joy, and I did finally get introduced to him at PASIC 2019, the last time PASIC was in person, through frequent podcast guest Emily Tennert Patterson. And fortunately, he was up for the interview. Tom's been teaching on the college level for the past 25 years or so, both at Texas and at Central Arkansas. He's been at the forefront of marimba performance and commissioning for many years, and has recently been doing great work as a percussionist for the well-known choir Conspirare. His work with that highly decorated group has impacted his teaching in fairly profound ways. Additionally, Tom was starting to do this whole podcasting thing before it even existed as a term. He did a video series on percussion during the 2000s that would be a whole lot easier to pull off these days. Also, as previously alluded to, Tom's a big sports fan, and we cover that more in depth in part two. Once again, two parts, because there's just a lot to talk about. On today's show, we'll cover Tom's beginnings as a professor, his job at Texas, issues of social justice and stress, and having a pretty well-known cousin in the marimba and percussion game as well. And next week, we'll cover the rest of the story. So let's get to it. We recorded this interview over Zoom on March 5th, 2021, and it begins right now. Well, Tom, give me a summation of your percussion activities and responsibilities as they are at this point.
Well, this is, I think, year 19 for me at the University of Texas at Austin, and it's hard to believe it's been that long. There I sort of direct the percussion program. So obviously it's a, you know, it's a pretty intense sort of undertaking, but I have some great help with some amazing graduate students and my cohort faculty member, Tony Edwards, who's a principal timpanist in the Austin Symphony. So basically he and I sort of teach all the students. We have about around 30 between, you know, about 7 or 8, maybe 9 graduate students to 20 or so, 20, you know, undergraduates. So that's a bulk of my, you know, sort of activity within my career. And then, of course, there's a lot of the solo performing stuff. I've sort of been, you know, pretty regular in the marimba, you know, solo marimba world, but actually have been very busy in a few other things that I never thought I would do. Most commonly playing with this very well-known choir called Consperare. Never thought I would work with singers as much as I have. And then, of course, just chamber music in general here in Austin. It's been a really great mix of things. You know, I love playing the marimba, but there's a lot more to life and percussion. And
what?
And I know it's weird to hear a marimba guy say that.
Probably, yeah.
But it's been really fun to get the opportunity to do a wide variety of things. Actually, I play mostly drum set with the choir. So that's sort of, that was my entry point into percussion in the very beginning of all things for me anyway. And so it's nice to kind of come back to that. I think that's a very general overview of sort of what I've been up to for, I don't know, the last 20 years or so.
Got it. Well, let's just because you, that was the most recent thing you mentioned. Tell me a little bit more about playing with this Consperare group.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to kind of summarize here, but Consperare means to breathe together. And it's a group kind of, I guess, loosely based here in Austin. The director lives here. His name is Craig Hallett Johnson. He's, I think pretty easily, I could say he's the greatest musician that I've sort of had the privilege of working with. You know, it's the closest thing to like living with Mozart would have been like. It's ridiculous. there are some singers based here, but they're kind of internationally and nationally all from all over the country. And they come here for concerts and sometimes we travel. And so if you're familiar with Roomful of Teeth, which is a very mm-hmm. well-known contemporary vocal ensemble, several of those singers are in this group. So that's kind of the caliber of the singing, which is just off the charts, just yeah. ridiculous. The first time I played with them, actually, maybe 15, 16 years ago, I was between the director and the choir and playing my sort of part, Stephen Paulus piece. I don't remember the name of the piece off the top of my head, but I was so struck with the communication and the intonation and the excellence of what I was hearing. I could barely play anything right. It was so freaky. I do everything from sort of classical stuff with them to, one of the hallmarks of the group is the director likes these sort of collage programs that sort of flow from one thing to another, and, styles are sort of all over the place. The biggest work we've done with them that's similar to this, it's, a piece called, Considering Matthew Shepard, which is a sort of modern oratorio after the story of what sort of happened with Matthew, and so, you know, because that crime happened in Wyoming, you know, the piece opens with a country tune of the fence that the boys that sort of beat Matthew up hung him on a fence. Not to get too serious here in the beginning of the show, but, but anyway, the opening scene there is, well, it's early in the oratorio. Is sort of a country song because it's out in the country by a fence, you know, and so I'm playing brushes on a cajon, you know, and in other programs we'll do some sort of Alicia Keys tune or some tune with like a big drum set part or jazz, and the styles are all over the place, but I never quite know what's going to happen. I found myself busier with that group than I ever thought I would, but it's been probably some of the most rewarding performance experiences I think I've ever had. And they've won multiple Grammys at this point. And so they're, you know, they have a high profile. And we toured Matthew Shepard across the country, I don't know, probably since 2015 to right before the pandemic. So that's been a really amazing experience. Because the show is a concert piece, but it's also kind of a theater piece where there's staging. And if you haven't heard it or listened to it, I highly recommend it. It's really really quite an amazing piece of music. So I think, you know, there's some, I love sort of what the group stands up for, you know, and, you know, they put a stake in the ground about a lot of things that are important that I think very relevant to where we are today as a society and, you know, inclusiveness and acceptance and all of these things. And so that's had a real effect on sort of my programming, what I'm working on personally in my performances and with my groups at UT, you know, which we can get into that a little bit. At
some point. I was gonna say in what way has that manifested in your studio stuff?
I think we all know this as artists, and some of us are, and we don't seem to talk about it very much, but you know, when we think about like, why do we do this music thing? You know what I mean? Like what helped us, what drew us to that point? And you know, we always talk about these experiences we had when we were younger, where we were just like blown away, or we remember a certain event or something that really got us kind of hooked. Right. And, I think for me, and I can't speak for anybody else, of course, but it seems to me a common answer to that question is, you know, something that really affected us emotionally, you know? And so I've really been, you know, I've always known this to be true in my teaching and my playing over the years. But I think especially since working with this group, they just sort of beat this reminder into you constantly as you're playing with them and singing with them that, you know, yeah, I mean, we need to make a living. And, you know, a lot of these singers, that's what they do. They don't have teaching jobs like I do, or that's their whole gig. Some of them don't even have apartments, you know, because they're just living on the road constantly, you know. But, you know, I think from the director, it's just a constant sort of sense of, you know, we have the power within the arts to really affect society and to really improve people's lives and to help them remember what it's like to be human, you know. And the arts has always had that sort of role in society from the very beginning. It's probably why it even exists, right? So I'm interested more and more lately of really not losing track of that as we go about our programming, right? Our teaching, you know, there's such an invigoration to that reminder that we can, you know, that we don't, yeah, there's nothing wrong with going to a gig for a job, right? And making money to put food on the table. And that's great. But one of my favorite things about this particular, job that I have with them is that it's that, but it's a whole lot more than that. It's this sort of unified, sort of consistent focus on, you know, if we are thinking about these things together, that can impact the audience in a much more profound way, if that makes sense. So this is something that in my own performance, I'm looking at trying to create, whether it be with, you know, my solo performances, you know, trying to find pieces that, you know, affect listeners maybe in a different kind of way. And these are all really subtle things. You know, my 2015 concert at PASIC was maybe a kind of an attempt at this, you know, where we had like three different, we had a Bach cello suite and then an Ishii, super edgy Ishii Japanese piece mixed in with some American rumba music that we sort of, you know, sort of ebbed and flowed through you know, what do these pieces have to say collectively, for example, rather than just presenting each of them by themselves. So I think, with the percussion ensemble at UT, you know, we were fortunate enough to be selected to play at PASIC 2020, which of course never happened. Right. Well, it did virtually. Yeah. And so, it's kind of a long story, but really quickly, you know, early discussions was, well, let's, you know, okay, put a program together, record it, and we'll show it during the virtual convention. And, that seemed like a great idea at first, except not all the other schools could even do that for any number of reasons. Some couldn't even meet because of the pandemic. Yeah. So that didn't quite seem right to have some groups be able to put something in and others not.
Right.
So, anyway, we decided that we had already, by the time all that was figured out, we had sort of planned this program anyway. And, so we decided we were going to do it regardless, and it's still not finished, which is another story. Actually, it should be done in the next, I don't know, what's today, March 4th, 5th? I'm hoping sometime this month it'll be finished. And so if you're hearing this, you know, in this timeline, in this month of March 21, I guess, you can keep an eye out for that. But, you know, this summer, right, we had all kinds of, it's just been a crazy year, not only just with the pandemic, but with the social, the racial injustice that we see, and all these things with Black Lives Matters, and all these things that we've been kind of going through together. And so the program is sort of loosely based on like drawing some attention to that, right? And what in this moment that we have, not really making a political statement necessarily, but just saying like, what can we learn during this time, you know, where we're all separated, where we're all not being able to do things the way we are used to doing them? What can we learn from what's going on around us, you know, in our country and the divisiveness that we see? So we're using a piece by Yaz Lancaster called, one of the movements called Disarmed. And it's essentially about gun control, you know, and not really picking a side, but just sort of, let's talk about this, you know, like, what are we going to do here? You know? And as we see, really the whole concert, which I think will be just kind of one 50-minute kind of collage sort of connection concert, will, really, I think generally speaking, sort of celebrates this younger generation that is just like standing up and saying enough's enough about these things. You know, it started with the school shootings and, you know, all the protests with that. And that was pre-pandemic, of course, right? And, you know, sort of ebbed and flowed through all the events of this summer. And locally, actually, at UT Austin, we have this big thing that's going on right now with the Eyes of Texas, our school song, right, that is sort of has deep roots in sort of racist tones to it, you know, and you wouldn't really know it just by hearing it. Everyone knows it, you know. But, you know, there are members of the Longhorn Band and the football team also that just refuse to stay on the field and all this whole thing. And these people are standing up, these kids, these college students are standing up to these, the richest donors in Texas.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
They're just saying, forget it. No, you're not hearing us and we're not doing it, you know? And that's such pressure. It's so inspiring. So really the program sort of celebrates just that kind of, that generation that's just refusing, right, to not let the conversation happen, you know, to not let us sort of remember, okay, let's talk about this, right? Because this is important. So, yeah, I think that's maybe a long-winded answer to your question, but, you know, I guess, you know, you've been doing something as long as I have, you start to really, you know, with every passing day and year, you get a little more focused on, you know, what, you know, not that I haven't ever been serious about like, what are we doing here? Right. But, you know, it changes and, you know, especially living through what we're going through right now, you know?
Yeah, that controversy with the song just continues. It's been a thing for nearly a year now, probably. I mean, almost, yeah. Right?
Yep. And actually,
it's still raging.
Yeah, it's totally right now. It is. Yeah, the Texas Tribune, which is sort of the Texas paper here, you know, is publishing emails of donors, and you know, it's hard to hear, but at the same time, and most of us aren't surprised, you know. We kind of knew a lot of this was going on. So you know, it's not really taking a stand during all these things, but clearly there's an issue here. So let's have a conversation, you know, let's talk about it. And the arts, I think, has that. And the role of the arts in all this, right, is really, I think, our ability to sort of center people, right? People on this side versus this side, and so far apart. And that we have this opportunity, I think, with what we do musically to sort of remind us that we're not really that different, none of us are that different, right? We obviously will have different opinions on this, but we are all the same in this way, and we all have to find a way to be together.
I mean, you know, what's a real challenge, I think one of the best things I heard about it on something like the Eyes of Texas is that for a lot of people they're just now like seeing what the connection to the old song was, you know, and like its racist past, but it's a hard thing to switch in your mind if you've never put that with the song. I mean, it might be with you could associate it very easily with like the greatest sports moments in your life. Like, you know, it has these other connections that are in place before it gets to where you realize the negative history.
Right. Exactly. It's a matter of perspective. You know, I'm not a Texan. I grew up in New York State, you know, Buffalo area, And so I, you know, I've been here for almost 20 years, of course. So, you know, Texas is, you know, it's all about football, right? I mean, we all know this about UT and just not even just UT, but the whole state in general. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand any of this coming here, you know, and I've been here 20 years and it hasn't been an issue. So, but when you put yourself in the, you know, in the, you know, in the foot of a black person, right? You know, that's the key, I think, right? What is the perspective there? What is it when that comes out, when that's been brought to everyone's attention, right? I think that's the key, right? Is sort of trying to understand it from that perspective.
Yeah. Well, and obviously what is also clear is that the sports that are most commonly associated, particularly for college athletes, that most people are aware of, are the ones with the highest African American populations in them, right. Which is the other element of what's, you know, what's going on and why it's so amazing that the students and the, you know, and so many of the athletes are standing up in this really challenging way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, they love the school, you know what right. I mean?
Yes.
It's not the school. It's not these things that we think maybe they might be. It's just the idea of it and the insensitivity of understanding of their perspective. Right.
Yeah.
And so let's just have a conversation about this in a real way, you know? And you know, 'cause we have to figure this out. I mean, we have to, right. And behind all this, of course, is just, you know, this, you know, it's just this, great wound in our country that just never seems to go away.
Right. Because we never address it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And so, you know, I think there's a huge opportunity as artists right now to, you know, this is our job and our role and our responsibility. That's just the way I see it. And, you know, this is just how I see it. This doesn't have to be how anybody else sees it. And I'm not trying to put that on anybody else,
right.
You know, but, you know, when you see something and you have the heart of the artist, right? I think artists are creative people. We feel things deeper and we feel the need to maybe do something about it, maybe more than some others. Because we're just feeling these things so deeply, right?
Right.
At least many of us are. And yeah. So it just, you know, I guess the older you get, the more important I think it becomes to at least feel like you're doing something, right? To bring this conversation forward and to do something with it.
Yeah. And I'll reiterate another point you made, which is the fact that the students and all the students who are kind of putting up these, where we're not playing it, as you said, love the school. If they didn't love the school, they would just be like, whatever. I mean,
right.
No, it's because they love the school and they want it to be better that they make this kind of, you know, plea, essentially.
Right. Absolutely. I'm trying to listen a lot right now, you know, yeah. And trying not to support and trying to understand, you know, and I think the arts ultimately has the power to help us all do that more and more.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and as we move forward as teachers and performers, I just think that's, you know, I think we've gone through lots of periods in our creative lives where these issues just haven't been in front of our face. Of course, they've always been there, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we feel them when we lose someone important to us in our life, right? We feel that connection to art and what we do and the importance of it. And so, you know, I just continually am fascinated by the timing of all these things, you know, this pandemic where none of us can really do what we want to do, at least to the fullest extent that we're used to doing them.
Right.
Right. And then all these things that are going on, it's like, how are we going to come out of this different? You know, is there something, as hard as this is there something for us to really learn from all this?
Yeah. Let's hope.
Yeah, I hope so too. I know. I hope so too. So anyway,
yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, the lay of the land, I guess. You know, and I think, you know, that's something that sort of pervades. I think the other thing that I've been interested too, that's very much a related idea, is this idea that taking barriers away from these silos in our lives. And I know I had these for many years, you know, I had my family life and my church life and, you know, I had my music and yeah, there were some connections, but you know, I mean, really if we're doing this the way that I see it anyway, which is, again, just the way that I see it. You know, all these things are the same. They're all these, you know, they're all connected. They're all the same. So if you're attending some organization that doesn't adhere to these things you're preaching about over here, like, I really started to feel those conflicts in my life. You know what I mean? And then making sure that whatever, you know, I'm a parent, I have three kids, two of them are out of the house now, you know, and I still have one here, you know, and, you know, what is our responsibility to him at this point, right? And to the other kids that we have, you know, are they seeing that we're putting our money where our mouth is, right? That the way we feel about this is affecting this other part, our professional part of our lives, if it's applicable, you know, and so on. So, and I think that's really important and something that, I find my students are really actually leading the way. They beat me to this. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, this is the deal to them. They're like, no, like, what are we doing now that is, you know, what's the point of this? Because it doesn't help us move forward in these other ways that are more important. And it's just been so inspiring to me, you know?
Yeah, 100%. 100%, particularly on the students being pushing us to, you know, to do better. In a kind of related way, has this because you're someone who's done, you know, so much performing, you've done a lot of commissioning, I'm going to assume, as mm-hmm. part of your performing, has this entered into, and, you know, if you think about your work with Inspirare, has this affected what pieces you commission, who you ask, who asks you? I mean, how is that, has that kind of weaved itself into your own performing life?
Yeah, I think so many of us right now, and actually I'm so encouraged by the work that I see inside our world, you know, whether that be just the general classical music world, or even inside the percussion world, the work that so many are doing to support composers from underrepresented groups, you know, I mean, it's really been inspiring. I've seen so much action there. It's fantastic. This concert that we're doing, that we're going to be releasing soon, has two Black composers as part of that. And I have not always been as good about that in the past. You know what I mean? I'll just come right out and say it. It wasn't because I didn't want to, or I refused to. I can tell you that and be in all honesty. It just wasn't something that was brought to my attention that we needed to change. You know, I think we all can do more from this perspective of, you know, just admitting, you know, look, I haven't done very well with this.
Yeah.
And we need to do better, you know? So, and we also programmed Devante Hines, piece, Perfectly Voiceless, which I love. That title seems to work so well with sort of the themes running through the program that we have, you know, that's a piece that was championed by Third Coast Percussion and is kind of being done more and more now. Has this great energy to it. That's like, propulsive somehow, right? The piece just has this great sense of like, okay, let's do some work. You know what I mean? Let's get in there and like, let's figure out what this is going to look like. You know, let's, you know, I think the program kind of starts a little bit with this idea of struggle, right? Like, okay, we've got these serious problems. Like what are we going to do about this? And oh man, like as we self-examine ourselves, and I think that I've been through a lot of that in the last 6 months of, you know, trying to figure out the ways that I haven't done a good job in these ways, you know, up till now, and really trying to think about ways to move things forward. And so I love this piece by Devante, because it's just like, all right, so we acknowledge these things that we need to change and that are problematic. And here we can start to think about, okay, what can we do about it? You know? So, in a previous performance the year before, I did this great piece by Valerie Coleman for flute and percussion, it is an incredible experience. And I had a wonderful colleague invite me to do some vocal, a duo for marimba and piano that he had asked me like 3 or 4 years ago. And we agreed to do it back then. We just couldn't find a venue. And so it all worked out really, really well. And for that particular concert, it wouldn't have been rep that I would have done 3 or 4 years ago, you know? And to some degree, it was a little bit uncomfortable, it would have been very easy in both cases maybe to say, oh, but then I have to learn that, or I have to learn how to play this instrument, or ooh, that looks really hard, that movement. But you know, you stay committed to it and then you do it. And then if you have the right kind of perspective about it and the right heart about it, you know, it can really turn out to be something special, you know? So, I mean, it hasn't been enough and I didn't do enough for the longest time, but I'm doing my best since 2017 or so, you know, to include more of these types of things. Through the program at UT, we were a part of the Adam Grow organization of the recent commissioning project that he did called Everybody Hits, I think is what it's called. And that was I think 6 or 7 composers, all from underrepresented groups, commissioning project for like chamber percussion ensemble. So we were a part of that. And I was so happy to see this, how many programs joined on to that. You know, it's really, really great. So we just have a lot of work to do and a lot of catching up to do, I guess, you know? So I think those are some things that I think have happened in the last 4 or 5 years that I think, you know, are a good start. I think that's the key, right?
Yeah.
We need to continue, you know, this can't just be something we do in 2021 and 2022 and 2023, right? Like, and I'm not looking to get any attention for any of this, of course, because I have to do it for the rest of my career before anybody will believe that it's actual change, right? And that's the key, I think. At least that's the way I perceive it.
Yeah. I would agree. It can't be. Yeah. It just has to be a muscle that gets exercised regularly, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, like anything, right? You know, it becomes something like a skill, you know, where it's just, you know, it just becomes part of who you are. And that's it. You know, I've already, you know, I think I just was looking at a bunch of applications, for PASIC, mm-hmm. right? So who's going to come present at PASIC, you know? And this thought is always there, you know, is this inclusive, right?
Right.
If we go with these 5 top things, if we've got 10 things that are all really quite good, right? Where there's not much difference in quality between all 10 of those applications, just as an example, mm-hmm. you know, we've got to find the right mix of those, right? And so that's, I think... If we practice these things right, that's the key, because then eventually it just sort of seeps into everything you do. And of course, you know, I've got a lot more work to do. One of the things that's helped me is to think about programming a little differently. This theme idea, that I've talked about already, right, is something that, you know, when you start getting into these kinds of topics, you know, as much as, you know, already you're telling the story because it's you programming it and it's your ensemble playing it. Right. But the what's so important with if there is a theme behind the program, like there is in this case, you know, we need the right perspective, right? We need that perspective to tell the story compositionally. Right. And so those are the sort of things I think that are beneficial, because then it sort of seeps in, you know, and of course, there's nothing wrong with including a piece from an underrepresented composer on any piece just because it's a great piece. Of course, that's totally fine.
Yeah.
But you have to be careful, right? Because, you know, we've seen it all the time. It was just a big thing on Facebook recently. I won't mention the institution, mm-hmm. Who had the best intentions, and then, you know,
I know.
And you know, that's just why we need to keep doing the work. Right.
Right.
Because the intentions there were obviously very good. It's just the publicity just was revealing in the wrong kinds of ways. And these are really scary things, you know, in this production that we're working on, you know, this recording we're about to, you know, release, the production company, I'm trusting as much as possible telling this very delicate, or what could be very delicate. You know, to me, it's a celebration of this younger generation that has nothing to do with race, right? But not everyone's going to get that, right? And so a lot of people are going to be jumping to conclusions, possibly, right? And so even though your heart is pure about it, right, you have to be careful, because my studio is not diverse enough to tell a story like that, probably, right? And so you just have to be, you just have to have conversations about those types of things and, you know, and be ready for, I guess, controversy if that's the case. But we have to do something.
Yeah.
Right. We can't just kind of, you know, I'm not interested in throwing in that towel just because it's hard, right? Or because right. it could lead to some disaster thing. But that's why you have the right people involved in the project that can help guide you, you know, for sure. So
let's back up. So where, tell me a little bit about getting the position at Texas,
yeah.
where you were before then, the status of the program as you came in.
Sure.
Start there.
Yeah, great. So my first position was at University of Central Arkansas. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I had never lived in Arkansas and was leaving Chicago to go there and was just starting a family. So, you know, in some ways it was great because we just had this nice quiet little life with the place and starting this job. And it was a great first job actually. And I was doing half band directing, half percussion. Mm-hmm. And I do have an undergrad sort of, music ed degree from Ithaca College. And student taught conducting bands and actually really love conducting. I kind of wish I could do it a lot more. It was a great first job in that way. And they wanted it to, they said when I got there that if I built up the percussion numbers, that eventually it might even become like a kind of a full-time percussion job. So that was sort of my goal going in. So I was there for, you know, from 97 to like 2001. And had I stayed there, I think it would have gone to a full-time percussion job. You know, because it was a great, there was a lot of support there. It was, you know, a lot of students in the area and it was, it's kind of easy there to get some momentum going, as it were. And then of course, Blake Tyson replaced me there, which was amazing because Blake is a great friend and we were in school together for a year during our master's degree. And so to see him end up there was just awesome. And so then I got to Texas in 2001. And, you know, I was pretty early in my career still. And so when I applied for the job, I wasn't really thinking anything would come out of it. But I was just getting started with my performing career at the time and had a big break in 2000 at PASIC in Dallas, where I got to play a solo piece as part of this big Marimba celebration day that Robert Van Cise had organized. George Frock, my predecessor at UT, just happened to announce his retirement like right before that. And that was going to be his last year. So,
and he had been there a while, right?
Yeah. 34 or 36 years for a long time. Yeah. For a long time. So, of course the convention was in Dallas that year. And so director of bands at UT, Jerry Junkin was going up to just talk to people at PASIC, you know, cause they knew they were going to about to do a search and he just wanted to get to talk to some people and he didn't come to talk to me, which is fine. Jerry, I don't hold you against you. It all worked out, you know,
I will never bring this up every time I see you, Jerry.
Yeah, of course he wouldn't because why would he? I was like nobody then, you know,
right.
So or very unknown, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, somehow, I don't know if he came to my performance. I'm not sure, you know, on that Wednesday, which used to be the New Music Day in the old mm-hmm. sort of PASIC formula, yep. you know, or if my name just sort of came up as someone they should kind of look at. I have no idea, but you never know. You never know who's, you know, that's what I tell my students all the time. You never know who's going to be watching you or listening to you, or
right.
you never know who's might recommend you for something. You know, it's like, that's such a big lesson there to learn. And then I applied for it like not long after that and thought, well, I'll never hear from them. And got interest also at TCU, I think, and at Belmont and UT that spring. And so it's kind of an exciting time because I just didn't know if we were going to be moving and where and all of that. And so long story short is it went really late into May and it's supposed to be, you know, as the NASM guidelines, it's supposed to be like May 1st where they make all these decisions. And I was here like auditioning in February. And so like the end of February all the way to like May 10th or something was just, everything was up in the air and it just sort of, well, for whatever reason sort of fell my way. So, I was super excited of course. And, you know, I realized, you know, George did a great job here, you know, for many, many years. I just really felt like I could come in and bring some new energy and you know, I was looking forward to doing some things like bringing the ensemble to PASIC. And, you know, there weren't very many students at the time. There were maybe 10 majors, which seemed kind of crazy to me. you know, based on the ensemble needs and everything that happens in the school. And right. I don't know how those students did it, but so now we're up to, you know, 25, 30, and we still feel like we don't have enough, but anyway, it was just it was just a great opportunity to sort of see what the possibility was, you know, that this place could do. So it's been a total blast. It's been a great fit. You know, my colleagues there are, you know, we see so many things the same way philosophically, you know, and what we think the importance of performance, not just because we want to have the best ensembles, but just, you know, the importance of developing superior musicianship in students and what that can mean, whether they're teaching elementary school, you know, kids, or getting in front of their high school bands, or moving on to conservatory or whatever, right? It's just really developing that musicianship in each of them. So whatever it is they end up doing in music, you know, they have really high expectations, and they have this ideal of, we got to make the best possible music at every second possible, you know? Yeah. So, it's been this incredible, incredible journey. I've been so fortunate and been loving every minute of it.
Now, when you get there, what kinds of things are you, because you're replacing a legend. I mean, you're replacing mm-hmm. somebody who's like incredibly well-known. I probably built the program himself. I mean, if not,
he did. Yep.
And so what kind of things did you feel like challenges, things you're like, okay, this is, I have to like adjust myself to make this position. What were some of the early decisions you had to think about because of the kind of the way you're taking over this, you know, well-known program from a very well-known pedagogue?
That's a great question. I think mostly it was just kind of a newer energy. You know what I mean? Like a more active energy. I mean, there were lots of things going on here, you know, but there was also a lot of potential that I saw that wasn't really happening. You know, the percussion ensemble, for example, was, I think, an area that could really develop into something a bit more, you know, and then really, really kind of building the percussion faculty. I mean, George was, you know, maybe because there were only 12 students or 10 students there, he was the only teacher. You know, I mean, we consider our peer institutions to be, you know, like Indiana and Michigan, right? And they all have multiple teachers, still have more than we do, you know, by almost double, you know. So there was a lot of building to do there, right? We need to have more than just one person teaching here, because this is a huge school, you know, and it needs to be more commensurate with, you know, it's in the recruiting game, it's hard, you know, when you have students that are looking at all these programs and they can go and study with four people over here or just one person here, you know what I mean? So there's that, you know, and then just bringing them maybe a more national level approach to what's happening, whether that be through the percussion ensemble and traveling to PASIC and playing, you know, or developing, just, you know, sending students out to conservatories or whatever the case might be. You know, whenever you come in and replace someone who's been there for so long and had such a legacy, you know, there is still a thirst usually for some new energy. You know what I mean? As good as that previous person is, you know, and this will happen to me eventually, you know, I'm not going to be able to be playing percussion concertos with the wind ensemble often and all these things. At some point, that's going to have to start really tapering off. Hopefully not for a while still, but you know, there is room for, okay, so now we can get more students here. Now we can, you know, we can, do this kind of repertoire with this new percussion professor that maybe we just haven't been able to do for a while, you know? So I think, you know, early on, it was just really important to sort of bring those numbers up, to show them a little bit more of what other possibilities could be, you know? And then to just really invest in your, you know, cause you have to, obviously that was, you know, it's very tricky to continue to, you know, develop your own a professional performance, you know, level of experience so you can get tenure someday in a place like that. You know what I mean? So there was just a lot of focus on my own practice and trying to play bigger and better things and, you know, all that goes into that. So, and that's, you know, of course, that's all when you're like starting your family and you've got young kids running around, your wife's like, stop. You know,
you are going to come home today, right?
yeah, exactly. Oh man, I have so many stories, you know. So, but you know, I think for me personally, I just saw like this sleeping giant a little bit, you know, like maybe that's a little too harsh of, I don't want to say anything. George is a great guy and you know, we still talk all the time and he's so supportive of what we're doing. And, I just saw a lot of other possibilities, you know, to take to the school. And there was such, for the most part, there's been nothing but really great support for that.
Great. Yeah. In a related sense, what kinds of things since you've been there and now you're no longer the new kid, I'm going to assume, but what kinds of things how has the job adjusted, changed, in your time since you've been there?
Yeah. It's, the problem is, Pete, I'm a builder. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I loved that early phase of being there because I just felt like I was not putting the program was on the map, but it was like, what could it look like with my leadership? You know what I mean?
And
I loved that challenge.
Right. You know what I mean? And kind of on a related sense, you probably, I mean, you're a flagship institution. Like,
yeah, right.
It's like, it's almost you're just like pride. As much of anything, and probably just you, I would assume that you knew that there were resources there that could probably get you to that point. Right.
Right. Exactly. And so that first phase, I mean, that's all part of the first phase, which is like, okay, insatiably looking for support here and support here and possibility here. And so from that perspective, that was what was so exciting about that first phase is it was just sort of endless possibilities there. You know what I mean? If you really were intense about looking for them and taking advantage of them. But you're right, that doesn't last forever. And, you know, from there, you know, I've never, ever, ever felt like I've been taken for granted here, you know, and I would never say that because it's not true. Yeah. But, you know, when you're a builder, when you want to kind of keep things moving in a direction, it is challenging sometimes because, you know, we're fortunate to, you know, right now we're in high recruiting season and, you know, we don't have the kind of student support that many of our peer institutions have. You know, we don't have the best scholarship situation and, you know, we get some amazing students that are interested in the program. And, but you know, at that point it was true for me and it was probably true for you at that point in your schooling, you need to not spend too much money to go to school. Yep. You know what I mean? And so,
you go to the best offer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're not at the top level. We're very high and it's great. I don't want to even give the impression that I'm complaining about this really at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you want to work with the top echelon students and you don't have the support to get them here, and you probably won't ever have that support, at least the way that you envision it, you do hit that wall, right? Mm-hmm. And so the challenge, and this is of course the challenge for every teacher, but, you know, we've sort of been, you know, every teacher has to in that situation, wherever you are in that wrong or whatever analogy you want to use is to, you know, okay, there is the expectation though. And I was just complaining to my wife about this earlier. There's this expectation that, you know, we still compete with our peer institutions just as well. If we have half the amount of faculty and half the amount of, or not as much support, right. Yeah. For scholarships, it doesn't matter. You still have to compete against them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Favorably, you know? So I think that's, it's not as glamorous, but that's the part of it is like, okay, the students that do come here, you know, they're amazing, absolutely incredible talents. And, you know, maybe they didn't rate as high as that top choice on your list for whatever year, but that doesn't mean they can't, you know, compete well, if not better than that person who decided to go somewhere else. So we're in that business of, it doesn't matter who comes, you know, we want them, you know, our job is to make them the best they can be and help them with the skills to be successful, you know, even though they may not have gotten into that top echelon choice that they were really hoping for, you know? So I think that's really, it's a lot of work and it's hard, but it's important, you know? And, the hardest thing for the past year, at least within the UT percussion program, and I'm sure I could speak for anybody that does this gig, is just not seeing the students, you know, not having that sense of community, which is so important. So I think we just try and, do everything we can, Tony and I, to really make sure that that dynamic is healthy always. So there's a sense of everybody can learn from each other, and there's a mentorship with the grads to the undergrads, and you know, that part of the learning experience, as hard as it's been the last year, is preserved no matter what. You know what I mean? So really, I think the answer to your question is there are certainly things we can do to develop our program, but we're not going to add 2 tenure track positions for the percussion faculty. You know what I mean?
Right.
We're not going to get another $50,000 to spend on scholarships just for the percussion studio. You know, it's just not going to happen. I mean, I guess anything could happen, but I don't see it happening.
Right.
So what do we, if we can't do that, what are the things that we can do? And that's just, you know, continue to invest in the students in the deepest way we can, so they can be as successful as they can be, and providing the best environment for them to achieve those things.
Yeah. I mean, it is a particular challenge in Texas. I would imagine any Texas school would just be like, all right, well, it's like UNT, TCU, Commerce, Corpus Christi. Like, I mean, you just go down the list, Texas Tech, UTSA, like you just like, there are all these just fantastic programs and teachers. Like, it's almost like, what do you do? Right.
Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right. You know, luckily, there are a ton of amazing students here in Texas. You know what I mean? So there's also out-of-state students or out-of-state colleges and universities that love to get students from Texas, of course, right?
Yeah.
And Jim Campbell always busts me big time every time he gets a Texas student. He lets me know about it. You know what I mean? So the good news is that there are so many students in this area and so many great programs, you know, so there's that saving grace.
Yep.
But I think one issue we have actually is, you know, we have the Longhorn Band, which we referenced a little bit earlier, but it's more of the drum line in that in LHB is, you know, serves the band and the football team. It's, you know, it's like a Big Ten kind of traditional model. So that the drum line's not going to competitions and, like, you know, has this, it's known for just what it does and that's it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas, you know, the North Texas drumline, everybody knows about the North Texas drumline, right? And so many others in the state. And so it's a little hard sometimes for us because the marching percussion thing isn't quite as visible here. But that's just who we are and that's our model, right? Which is more like a Michigan or an Indiana, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it can be a little hard sometimes with these undergraduates in the state of Texas to understand sort of they I don't know what they think, honestly, but you know, it's just a very different model than most of the other programs in the state in that way. And so I guess we are looking, it's hard to tell these kids that, you know, really the main way, if you want to perform, is chamber music or orchestral playing. You know, there aren't any as professional wind bands that you can make a lot of money playing in, or marching bands or all that stuff. You know what I mean? So, that's the thing. So, yeah, but, you know, I think it's such a great community down here with all of these amazing programs and teachers. You know, we're all really supportive of each other and we all push each other in that way. So it's really a great community for sure.
I mean, the one benefit you do have is that you are in an awesome town. So that's kind of built in, right? soon after you got there, did you realize, like, this place is great?
Yeah. Well, you know, I always knew it was a great city, you know, and, you know, living in Arkansas, I came in, it's so funny. This is a funny story. When I was at Central Arkansas, mm-hmm. I actually came to UT to play on a percussion ensemble concert, not because George Frock asked me to, but because one of the grad students was playing a piece that I knew. It's a piece by Tom Hasenflug called Flat Iron Wolf, mm-hmm. and for solo marimba and like quartet. And I know you talked to Tom at some point, right?
I did,
podcast. That's awesome. He's one of my best friends. Great.
Yeah, he's great. You
know? Awesome guy.
Yeah.
Great composer too. Super. I mean, I think everybody in the percussion world kind of knows Tom, but his music is, I'm going to forget the name of it now. He wrote me a piece that I premiered at PASIC in 2006. That's one of the great marimba solos we have, I think. All Times Identical is what it's called. Just an incredible piece of music. Anyway, what was I talking about? I'm getting sidetracked here.
The town of Austin, that you had come to Austin before.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, like, it was like 98 or 99, and I came to play Tom's piece. And he actually, because he was at Seguin, teaching at Seguin at the time, and he came for the concert. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking around the school going, oh, my gosh, this would be, like, the perfect place for me, but I'll never in hell get this job. I'll never forget that. And of course, it was all this stuff with Bill Clinton going on, you know, during that time, because he was from Arkansas, you know, and it was, I think there was a big convention, maybe a DNC convention was, I don't know what was going on, but anyway, I always knew how great Austin was. And, when we moved here, it was sort of the end of the first sort of dot-com boom.
Right.
And so like housing was just like through the roof and, you know, but yeah, I think, it's definitely harder at the graduate level to get my master's students to leave, you know, because they all love the city and there's so much new music going on. And, you know, the Line Upon Line percussion guys are here. They're, you know, they're a resident sort of percussion group and they have their own series that they're playing, you know, in town. And there's so many other things going on. But there's also so much, like, there's so many great bands around here. So a lot of my students will be working with, you know, Vista Ridge and Vandegrift, all these super top of the level, top of the Leander High School, you know, bands. And so it's hard to get them to move on with their lives after their master's degree because I just want to stay and play and teach in these great programs, you know. So, yeah, that is a little bit of an embarrassment of riches. I'm not going to deny that as far as recruiting goes, for sure. The undergrads maybe, I don't know if they get that as much. I think a lot of them eventually like it more, but I think sometimes they think it's like this – totally, especially if they come from, you know, down south down south Texas or something. It's this very kind of whoa, you know, kind of intense environment. So,
I had a good friend of mine who it's kind of funny when you mentioned the Big Ten schools. He ended up going to Michigan State to do, and this is not in percussion. This is in communication. But he visited UT Austin has one of the best communication programs, which is my wife's field. And he said he was going to do his PhD here, and he went like one day he went to Sixth Street, and he's like, I would get nothing done if I come here for grad school. I'm going to go to East Lansing.
There you go. There's so many interesting things about the city, you know. For sure. Lots of trouble you can get into.
Right. That was his point.
Yeah. He if he knows himself well, maybe he made the right decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
now he's doing great, but I remember that coming up like immediately. And then I hadn't been here yet. And I think there was not too long after that was the 06 PASIC. And I was like, gosh, I see. This town is awesome.
Yeah, it's been really great to have the convention here a bunch of times in the last, I don't know, 15 years or so. Yeah, that's been really fun. So, you know, I think it's you know, it's a very progressive city. You know, it's sort of the political base, right, of Texas. It's the artistic base of Texas. There's a huge tech scene here, you know. Yeah. And so it's a very exciting place. It's a very exciting place to be, for sure.
Yeah. Were you all affected by the, you know, what happened the last couple of weeks? Were you out of power?
Yes.
I bet you. Okay.
Well,
I didn't, cause I couldn't tell. I wasn't 100% sure which, like if it was every single part of Texas or if it was.
It was almost every single part, which is insane.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I grew up, you know, like I said earlier in New York, and it's easy, right, to jump in the car and drive to the next major city, like within an hour, sometimes less, usually no more than 2 hours, right? Here you can drive 10 hours before you get to the next city.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so it's crazy. And we were definitely affected. It was complete. It was crazy.
Yeah.
It was, if anyone thinks it was sensationalized in the news, it wasn't. I can tell you that.
Wow.
Because, you know, we were very fortunate to not lose power, but we did lose water for almost 6 days.
Mm.
And so you know, there, and the stores didn't have it. I was waiting in line 3 hours outside of Randall's, and they didn't have anything in there, you know. And, you know, and no one owns warm clothes. It was like 15 degrees and we're all, I mean, actually I had some warm clothes cause I travel, or I used to travel anyway. You know, nobody really has warm clothes. The housing here is not built for, I mean, the temperature was zero.
Yeah.
For, you know, a bunch of nights. And then it never went above 15 for like 3 or 4 days in a row. Like the pipes here aren't, it's just not built for that. And there is no salt for the roads. There are no plows, right? All these things that a lot of people do just maybe take for granted. So it's not that Texans are wusses by any stretch, because that was about as nuts. And so the power outages were meant to just be rolling because the network just couldn't take it, right? So it was like, we're going to black this out for a little while to take some of the pressure off. Mm-hmm. That didn't always work well. And we lost water because they took the water, the power away from the water plant without meaning to. So it's just all kinds of things went crazy bad. And, you know, I never thought I would be collecting snow and melting it in my bathtub to flush the toilets with, you know, and, boiling water wherever you could find it in case you had to like, really, I mean, I was very close to like, okay, this is like, this could get really bad, like really fast. So anyway, we were fortunate to not lose power, but the water thing was really problematic. And, you know, trees are just down everywhere because it was so much ice. It was just like inches of ice everywhere. It was completely nuts. So anyway, we made out much better than most. So I'm very thankful for that. But yeah, it was a really, I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
And I can't remember. I don't think I've ever been anything through that in my entire life, you know?
Yeah.
So it's crazy. And, you know, it is true that they could have been much more prepared. But we won't get into that.
Right. Yeah. It's. Yeah. So. I think it's the, I mean, I grew up in New York, I grew up on Long Island, different, but.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think it was until I knew I had family in Atlanta when I had an idea of like the difference when they get snow and why they would need to close for so long. It's like, well, you have no plows. Like you can't go anywhere.
Right. Right. And actually I didn't mention the snow accumulation. We had 6 inches, which almost never, I mean, never happens here. That's the first time that it happened since I've been here. You know what I mean? And, you know, we get cold, you know, we get 30, 32, 28, where it might snow and then it's gone like in 2 hours. That's usually the, you know, and it's no big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's not there very long. But this was a week straight, you know, and then once the snow fell, it was super cold for just a long time after that. So nothing was melting or going away.
Right.
And, you know, so it was just one of those perfect, perfect storms, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway. Yeah, it's been an interesting year, Pete. I'll tell you that.
Already. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Oh boy.
But we're thankful to be on the other side of that. So
Yeah, for sure. Let's back up now. So you said you grew up in Buffalo area? Like, I mean, because that's Buffalo.
South of Buffalo, Orchard Park.
Okay. So, home of the Bills.
Yes, that's right. And normally I'm like, I don't want to talk about the Bills, but actually I'm about to talk about the Bills right now. Of course. Just as long as we don't talk about the hockey team, you know?
Right.
That's disaster right now.
Are they still there? Like,
yeah, they are still there. I know it's hard to believe, but they are still there.
Yeah.
Yes. No, it was a great year. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
What an amazing, amazing year. We got really close. So that's been really fun. But yeah, and you know what? Sports is so funny because – it's really I love all my family's still in Buffalo, or most of them anyway. And, you know, I follow it like crazy. It's just really, I don't know. It's just my main way of connecting to where I grew up. You know what I mean? And it's easier now than ever, right? You know, 30, 40 years ago, I don't think anybody could really feel that connected after they leave a city that they were, you know, spent most of their young life in. My mother is a piano teacher. Well, she's retired now, but I was her worst piano student in that it wasn't like I couldn't play. It was just I just didn't want to. And, you know, she taught me a lot of theory, which I hated when I was younger, but made like theory class in college like a breeze, you know what I mean? And so I thanked her later. I actually did some singing too during those times, which I didn't really love either, but they made me do it. And mm-hmm. I'm now, and I think that was really important with how much work I do with, you know, singers these days. So I had a great, it was just super nurturing musically. I haven't told almost anybody this, but I was actually the lead in an opera when I was like a 9-10 year old, something like that.
Oh yeah.
Oh, a mall and the Night Visitors.
Yes.
Carlo Minotti. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a mall in one of the shows at Niagara University. And, it was really fun until, on a Friday matinee, like I'm like out in the hallway waiting for the show to start, and I see my teacher from my school. I was like, "What are you doing here?" "Oh, we brought the whole class."
You hadn't performed yet. This is what's key here.
No, I know I had. It's just I didn't really want anybody to know that I was like singing like. You know, like this is a treble, like, so you're singing like before your voice changes and it's super right. high, you know, it's like yep. a, you know, so anyway, I got lots of teasing for that, but whatever. So, that's a little bit about sort of where I started. And then, you know, when I got through high school, it was like, okay, what are you going to do with your life? I like sports. I did a lot of baseball. I played a lot of baseball and tennis when I was in high school, but I couldn't really pursue that professionally. And I sort of said, well, music's the only thing. It sort of brings my GPA up, you know? And this was like junior year. I don't know why it took me so long to figure that out, but it was, you know, Ithaca got on the map as far as a possible school, and I was like, okay, what do I have to do to get in there? And I'm looking online. Well, it wasn't online back then. I got the audition requirements or whatever, however you got them back in those days. And a four mallet marimba solo. I don't know how to do that. I knew how to read music, but I, you know, my band program didn't have a percussion teacher like not every school here does, but many schools have percussion teachers here in Texas, the high school level. And so I had to go find a teacher and learn four mallets really quickly. And then all of a sudden I was playing for Gordon Stout for my audition, and somehow he let me in. I was very surprised at the time. And of course, during that time, Michael Burrett, my cousin, was kind of, you know, I didn't see him all that often, but we were, you know, somewhat close. And he, you know, he was, I think, just getting out of college. No, he was just starting his teaching career at that point. So I did have that sort of touch point there to see what was kind of going on. And somehow we ended up kind of doing very similar things. It wasn't really intentional, but I actually wanted to be a trombone player like my dad was. And my parents said, no, we want you to do percussion. I was like, okay. That's not usually how that story goes. I think I just realized there was nothing else I could really do. And so, you know, then I got to Ithaca and it was just like, you know, I saw Gordon's first recital there, or the first recital I saw him do there. It just sort of blew my mind. And then a guy named Dave Hall, who's the principal timpanist in Grand Rapids Symphony. He graduated a number of years before I showed up at Ithaca, played this insane recital, like Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, Night Rhapsody, which is a big piece of mine that I play. Like Marimba Spiritual, Chaconne, like it's a crazy
all the big ones.
Yeah, it was just
time,
insane.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, what is going on here? And I was like, I think this was like maybe first semester freshman year, and I heard him play Night Rhapsody, and I was, I'm playing that piece. Like, I'm just going to do it.
Yeah,
and I started like as soon as the minute I looked in the Steve Weiss catalog. You know,
it's here.
What do you want? You know,
yeah, of course. Yes.
That's how we used to do it back in the day.
That's what. See, this
I'm
is.
Sorry,
I
I'm
love
Mr. Joyce. Just okay. Hold on.
I listen, Tom. I so love it whenever anyone brings up the terror of having to call Steve Weiss, and you're like, because I the way I think about it is when I first had to make a call and I was trying to order like the Innovative Percussion 300s, and I'm like,
yeah,
I was like, I need two pair, and he's like, what color? Aqua. It's like, okay, three, just like, just say IP 300s. I was like, All right. Like, you know, like I can't like get my head around what I've just, this for interaction
those,
I just had.
Yeah. For those listening who have seen Seinfeld and the soup Nazi.
Yeah.
That's
right.
That's exactly what it was. And the only other thing that was like that for me was, you know, when I referenced my early time here at Texas,
trying
to like get things going and like playing as much as I could. And when I was traveling, you know, we had such little kids at the time, and I always worried about calling home like that, like what my wife was going to be like with being with the kids for that long without me. So anyway, where was I? Oh yeah. So that really changed my life. And, then I just fell in love with the marimba and like didn't really do much of anything else. I mean, I did, but you know, I just was so obsessed with it and was practicing ungodly, unhealthy hours just cause I was so into it. And, yeah. And so, you know, Gordon has been one of those just so important influences on my life, and I owe him so much. And, he really showed me the possibilities of what we could do, you know, as players and performers in this field. And, I think that's, you know, that was just such a lasting experience on me, you know, that experience there. So then it was, you know, okay, do you want to continue with school? You know, getting a band directing job, unfortunately, right, usually means you're not going to be able to play much anymore. You know, that's really unfortunate, and I wish that would change or could change, because I think that's really problematic for a lot of people who, you know, who want to go into teaching. And so really to me at that point, because I didn't want to stop playing because it was important to me, but, you know, college teaching was really the only option. So not knowing, you know, and I tell all my doctoral students, you have to go into this thing not expecting it to really ever pay off or work out even, you know. And so I just kept going and kept going and kept going and did the, I think one thing that really helped was the 95 marimba competition, the Lee Howard Cedars 1995 marimba competition. I didn't really place in that, but I did well enough. It was kind of like American Idol. If you get in that top group, mm-hmm. you know, people notice that, you know, and that sort of put me on the map with some early endorsements. And then that sort of led to my pace of performance in 2000, which led to the next thing and so on and so forth. And you never know, right? Any time you do any of these things, if anything will come of them.
Yeah.
But that's not why you do them or expect to have anything come of them. It's just because you're just striving and you're learning and you're just doing everything you can and you make the best relationships you can and don't, you know, burn any bridges, all those things. And then you just kind of see where it goes, you know? So, yeah, I think that kind of gives you an idea of sort of the journey real quickly from the very beginning, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's get into a couple of elements. I just because you brought them up, have you and Mike ever just had a conversation like, isn't it weird that we're both kind of doing the same thing? Like, yes. and this is going to be a question that's going to come up to both of us all the time.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. We're really close. You know what I mean? Like, we talk often and, both of us have such a strong family bond, not just to each other, but to our family, you know, because most of his family is in Rochester, which is only an hour away from kind of the Buffalo, as you know.
Yep.
You know, he's taught me so much, not just about percussion, of course, but just about, life in general and, you know, doing the things that are important to set yourself up and to be successful. And, you know, I think, you know, my mother wanted me to be a pianist, you know, and as much as I didn't really want that early on, I think what I saw in the marimba was kind of the percussion equivalent of that, at least in possibility, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Concerning with, you know, just harmonic and melody, harmonic and, you know, these being able to play more. And if you think about it, like, you know, not many musicians can even make one sound more than one sound at a time. Right. So it actually, if you're interested in that possibility, right, it's one of the fewer possibilities out there. It's not keyboard especially. So, right. I think that's really sort of, so I think I kind of came to it from that perspective.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, Mike was there, you know, playing at PASIC in 88 in San Antonio. I didn't go, but he was like a super, I remember him being super excited about it because I was still in high school at the time. And, you know, I saw him publishing his early pieces and all these things, you know, and his trajectory from Kent State to, you know, I was kind of course, because we were always talking, you know. And so I think if more than anything, I think he showed me what was possible as far as a career goes and sort of, you know, he's like everybody's best friend, you know, I mean, he's super funny, you know, he could talk to anybody, he could charm anybody, you know, all these amazing personality traits that he has, you know, and that says, of course, nothing about his incredible musicianship and those, all those other things that go along with it. So, yeah, I think, you know, we're really cut from the same cloth and we loved it. That's the one thing we've definitely said to each other, you know, and,
I think, and he's also a big coffee person too, if I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, I love that about him, but he definitely doesn't need caffeine. if you know him, you know what I'm saying? Like, so I think he's been trying to become more of a tea person, you know,
settle down to a hair.
Although I know my students have epic stories about me being over caffeinated in lessons. So, you know, who am I to say? Who am I to say?
That's hilarious. I wonder if there are times when, you know, if a student will be like, "Do you know Mike Burritt?" And you'd be like, I don't know who."
No, like, I mean, there's so many.
Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah. Sometimes, there's so many different ways you could joke about it, right? Sometimes, if I'm at it, you know. Doing a clinic somewhere and someone says, "Yeah, I'm playing, October Night by Muckabert." And I'm like, "Who?" I got to be really careful though, because he's way better at wasting people than I am at wasting people. You know what I mean? So I had to be really careful because I just can't, I'm perfectly comfortable saying there's no way I could hang with that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So some people do get confused though. Some people think that we're first cousins, just not that this is some big story that needs to be cleared up, but I do, people are often wonder if he's my dad, you know, and obviously he hates that.
Right,
you know? So there's lots of jokes about that, you know, for sure. My favorite joke, I think it's not really a joke, but it's more of an anecdote, but you know, there's only one Dr. Burritt, you know, so.
Nice.
So, you know, I had fun with that one, but
yeah,
it's all good fun, you know.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So,
that's hilarious.
But, yeah, yeah, you know, it has, you know, on the more serious side of this conversation, you know, there has been, I'm sure there are people out there are like, oh well, you know, he just, you know, Tom is like, you know, how convenient, right, for him, you know, and I totally get that.
Yeah.
But you know, at some point. You know, at some point you have to prove yourself. You know what I mean?
Right,
at some point you have to really say, yeah, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, you know? Mm-hmm. And you don't, of course, do that just to prove that point, you know, you right. do it as it seeps through just everything you do, you know what I mean? From your teaching responsibilities to, you know, to the other things you're doing, you know? So his dad also was a very well-known band director and my dad was a band director briefly, also. So we have a long history in our family of music making and teaching, mm-hmm. especially teaching. And, you know, our grandmother, Eris was her name. She was a teacher in Cicero and Syracuse, you know? Yep. And so we have all of this in our blood, I guess, you know, and, it's important to acknowledge that, I think, you know, that in our community, you know, we all know Mike, you know, and, but it goes well, way, way before that in our family.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And this, and you know, his dad, Bruce, was actually really well known in New York. He started the New York State Field Band Conference.
Mm.
And right. I think just a couple of years ago, maybe longer than that, because maybe 4 or 5 years ago, was elected into the BOA Hall of Fame, I think.
Oh, wow.
Because he did so much judging with them. Mm. And he was a huge hero of mine growing up, like, you know, just as much, if not more so than Mike, because he was just, you know, so focused in this Burritt intensity, mm-hmm. you know, really he had it big time, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's been a really important figure in my life too, you know? So of course it goes well beyond and before, you know,
yeah.
He and I for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an awesome point about
it's like, okay, fine. Yes, I share the same name, but okay, that might get me like in a door, but I have to stay in the room. Like,
right.
I could be kicked right back out if I don't know what I'm doing.
So. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Who knows in that equation, you know, I mean, I probably benefited more than that was a struggle for me. I don't really know. You know, I think if it's benefited me, it's because of some of the things he taught me, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Over the years, you know, like, I remember my first concert at UT, was with the Wind Ensemble and playing the Schwanner Concerto, which was a piece that I knew so well, but I had never played it, you know, in that kind of situation. And certainly not with any kind of, you know, group, you know, like ensemble like that. And so I was super excited about it. It was like November. So I had just gotten there and like learned it really fast. And here we are, it's November and maybe like right before Pesach or something that year. And I've never been so nervous for a concert. And I remember sitting backstage right before going on and just kind of yawning like crazy. Like I could just fall asleep. My body was just so overwhelmed.
Wow.
That it was just, okay.
It's shutting down.
Yeah, it totally shut down. But and it freaked me out at the time. And Jerry Junkin was like, "Are you okay?
You all right? You know you're gonna play in a
can we do this shortly? Like because we're going out like in 30 seconds." And I was like, "I'm fine, totally." And I know many of you aren't watching my face here, but I wasn't really sure if I was fine, but I had to tell him that I was and assure him. You know what I mean? I think it was my body sort of instinctually saying, "Stop. You got this. You're ready for this. Just relax.
Yeah.
And since you can't do it on your own, we're going to do it for you." you know? And because it knew what was at stake, you know, it was the first, you know, so much of my success, unfortunately, was going to boil down to that one moment moving forward there, you know? And that stinks, right? That is like such a hard thing to accept, but it's our business, right? It's just like, whether that be any kind of audition you do or whatever, that's just the way it goes. You know what I mean? So, I think ever since then, every time that I have a super big important concert, like I start yawning.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And it's like one of those things that at first it freaked me out, and then it was okay. No, this is a signal from your body that it's time to do this thing. And accept it, take it in, and acknowledge it as being part of the process. And it's like, it's so cool when that kind of thing happens, because it's this validation that I think we all wish we had, right? Sometimes you just have to be open to experience it or find it, you know, or sense it even.
Mm-hmm. It's like the moment of you've acknowledged, I've put in the work, like I am actually ready.
Yeah.
No, it's like, here we go.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a hard thing, right? To be able to do that in the moment on your own or with your brain, with your mind, right?
Yeah.
So I guess the lesson there is maybe just to sort of trust your body. But I think the other part of this, you know, is the experiences I've had outside of UT, you know, Konzerthaus is the perfect example, you know, the experiences I've had outside of our percussion community, where you start building these lasting relationships in other parts of the music world, you know, really, really sort of affirm you too on the way of, yeah, this is what you're supposed to be doing, and you can do this. You know what I mean? And so I think that's I encourage all my students, especially my doctoral students, when they are getting their first jobs, is, you know, obviously take care of everything you need to do in your community there, but, you know, be open to, we're so used to operating within our world, you know what I mean? Right. Like our university or the PAS world or whatever, you know?
Right.
And obviously it's really critical. It's so much a part of the game and it's very, very important, but there's a lot more out there too, you know? And all of those things in some ways can be equally valuable or more valuable, just maybe in different ways. Like, you know, I recently actually was very lucky at the end of January to play a live recital, finally.
Mm-hmm.
It was very carefully, you know, limited seating in a huge room. And it was a really interesting experience after not really doing anything like that for over a year or almost a year. And what was so nice about it. It was like a, just a very general older audience, you know? So I love those kinds of audiences because they just don't look at what we're doing like we do, you know what I mean? Like a basic crowd concert mm-hmm. would look at it. Right. You know, they're looking at totally different perspective, you know? And that can be, I guess what I'm getting at is there's just, you know, I would encourage people that, you know, as they delve and dig into their communities to get inside their local scene as much as possible, you know, it can be so beneficial. And, you know, to play for different kinds of audiences, I think really has helped me kind of reevaluate sometimes why I'm and how I'm making sounds, you know, and in what ways I'm making sounds. What they're looking for from what you're there to do is very different than, you know, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know, you know, yeah. Yeah, and our Austin artistic community is very, very rich, like we mentioned earlier. And actually, we just did this, the Austin Classical Guitar Society, which is one of the really active groups inside the city, organized a storm benefit concert where they just got a bunch of us together and pulled like a bunch of streaming together and put together a streamed performance. And they raised $22,000 for the city. For four organizations that are working in the city to help people get through the storm. You know what I mean? So it feels really good to be invested in those kinds of things, you know, and to be a part of a community that cares about giving back. You know, when sometimes the government fails people, you know, we can step in and give them some, at least, of some things of what they might need, you know?
Yeah.
So those are some of the more, you know, those types of things for me have been just as fulfilling as anything I've done inside our bubble, you know, as it were, you know? So, and sometimes have maybe even more lasting consequences, you know, than in the bubble as it were.
Yeah. Well, I hope in that concert you had the mix of the people who were, you know, giving you the, you know, oh, I've never seen a marimba or like, you know, that kind of like this is just an amazing experience. And then you get the one person who's like, did you play that with 121s? I would have gone with 122s, you know, like just to like,
yeah.
give a little stick right there, you know?
Yes, totally. Yes, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. Like, but I was playing Graduate, you know, and then it's like, it just gets into the whole conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. What I think I value about not the mallet, obviously.
Right.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. No, but the, you know, the comments you get from some of those people after who haven't seen anybody play with four mouths before, right?
Yep.
Or they're not used to seeing percussion in that kind of environment where
right.
someone's actually really trying to say something by playing an instrument of percussion, right?
Yeah.
I'm always looking for comments that are more like, hey, you know, that was really amazing. I never thought percussion could be used in a meaningful, communicative way like that. You know what I mean? That's when I think we're getting somewhere with those types of audiences, right? When it's not just a gimmick. Like the last thing I want them to say is, man, you must be good with chopsticks or whatever, you know, like, man, how do you physically move the way you do when you play, you know, cause then they're not listening to the music, you know, they're not listening to what you're trying to say, you know what I mean? So musically. So I think that's, and we're just not used to that kind of line of thinking. I don't think inside our bubble, you know what I mean?
Right.
Cause we're not distracted, but we're thinking about your comment earlier about what mallets are using or,
right.
you know, what, you know, why did you stick it that way?
Yeah.
Or, you know, and those things are not, I don't mean to belittle those things, right? Those right. things have their time and place, you know, but I can tell you, you know, the older couple retired in Round Top, Texas, who just wants to go see a concert, mm-hmm. not thinking about those things.
Right. Yeah.
They want to be moved. They want to be taken somewhere, you know, they want to see something interesting and be sort of affected, you know? So.
Yeah. No, that totally, totally agree. Awesome.
We'll talk with Tom even more next week in part two, so stay tuned. This week's rave is the 2020 documentary, The Black Church. This is our story. This Is Our Song, produced, directed, and overseen by legendary filmmaker, documentarian, professor, and host of Finding Your Roots, all on PBS, Henry Louis Gates Jr. This is a monumental and important work that demands your attention and time. And because it's put together by Dr. Gates, really hits upon a ton of great information, music, interviews, and it's always worth your time. This great piece of art pretty clearly lays out the importance of Black church to the history of the United States and why it is so important. Among the items you learn, for one, the church, particularly in the South, was the first enclosed space in the United States that allowed enslaved persons to actually be themselves freely, and it was the center of all activities for Black populations in spiritual, social, economical, and every other way you can imagine. Additionally, that same space has always been seen as a threat to white populations in power. So with that as the backdrop, the documentary spends a lot of time explaining the influence of the Black church on music, denominations, emancipation, Reconstruction, voting rights, economic rights, social justice, LGBTQ populations. The list goes on and on. Additionally, the Black church spends a lot of time on the music of the church. You see the influence of popular secular styles of music on the sacred and vice versa, the growth of Black gospel music, the influence of spirituals and African folk music, and you see a lot of performances of this music. Also, there's a lot of focus on the role of women in the Black church, including the ways they've been powerful, as well as being kept out of positions of power in certain denominations. The movie also discusses the outside influences in and out of Black culture, the denominations that have further split, the influence of Black liberation theology, the influence of theatrical preaching styles, the Black Panthers, the Nation of Islam, etc., all gets talked about. It's a great history that should be required viewing whether you are a believer or not. And I'll point out again that what you see in this documentary is American history, and you should be seeing and understanding the ways that all Americans can see themselves and be connected in all of the circumstances you watch in this film. And with the very recent events involving the hate crimes towards Asian American and Pacific Islander citizens in Atlanta, these connections should be affirmed strongly. Check out The Black Church, This Is Our Story, This Is Our Song, now streaming on PBS. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. You can always find every episode and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there, on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at PetePerkPod@gmail.com. And I will catch you next week for part 2 with Tom Burnt. Until then.